May it please the court, my name is Dana Weiss, registration 36656, and I'm here on behalf of Mr. Holen. It is well established in a criminal trial that evidence of a defendant's unrelated prior criminality or criminal conduct is not admissible. This important principle is based upon the acknowledgement that admission of such evidence creates prejudice in the minds of the jury. Courts also have said that a presumption of guilt should not be generated against a defendant by showing that he committed a crime wholly unrelated and independent from the offense for which he stands trial. Further, when such evidence comes out during trial, normally a mistrial is required. And that goes back to Supreme Court precedent, back to People v. Goldsberry, Court of Appeals decisions in People v. Adams, People v. Moore, all of which are cited in my briefs. Additionally, these pronouncements are found in Coastal v. People and Stoll v. People, which is cited in Coastal.
Let me ask you, Ms. Weiss, if I can, why isn't this res gestae? Isn't this just what happened? I mean, the man said what he said, and it is clearly part of the story, and I recognize you get to a 403 issue after that, but right. Why isn't this res gestae?
Well, first, the trial court found or essentially employed a 404B analysis when this was addressed at the or during the morning of trial. So he went through a 404B analysis. My position is that this is not 404B, and neither is it res gestae. Even if it were res gestae, because this statement was made as part of the incidents that were being related at the trial level, a 403 analysis still is employed by the courts. And whether you consider it under a 403 analysis as res gestae or under a 404B analysis, one of those prongs being a 403 analysis, it's simply inadmissible based on Colorado courts' case law establishing that prior criminality is never admissible. And should it come in at trial, normally a mistrial is required. And in fact, is generally not considered harmless.
Well, go ahead, Judge.
Yeah, pardon me for interrupting, Ms. Weiss, but what should we make of the fact that it was your client who introduced his prior criminality into this offense as a matter of explaining why he wanted to sell this valuable piece of equipment?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And the reason that that doesn't make a difference is that the fact is that the evidence showed Mr. Arts testified that my client had made this statement that he was recently released from prison, and that's why he was selling the pipe threader, that times were tough, he needed the money, he was trying to start his own business. It was part and parcel of that statement that occurred during the telephone exchange when he was arranging the sale of the pipe threader. However, defendants make statements all the time, whether to police officers or witnesses. That evidence is normally excluded if it involves prior criminality of the defendant. And it matters because these important principles are anchored in constitutional
case law can you cite for that, counsel, where a defendant makes a statement about the transaction that may reference prior criminality and that part is excised?
Your Honor, that's just through practice. Generally, we don't see those types of cases because they are excised at pretrial conferences. For example, if the prosecution is going to admit the statements of a defendant, generally the parties work together to excise any references to prior criminality, and they get to, they essentially maintain the statement as it pertains to the incident itself. But any references to prior criminality generally are excised. And I think that that's why we don't see case law establishing that particular factual scenario, because it's generally held, and this principle is well established, that a defendant's prior criminality does not come in. So whether a defendant is giving a statement to police officers or whether the statement is given to witnesses who then ultimately testify, the fact remains that that information should be excised in order to uphold a defendant's due process right to a fair trial and an impartial jury.
Well, I can understand if you're talking about a statement to a police officer where the conversation runs the gamut from, well, I committed this crime for reason X, and oh, have you ever been in trouble? Yes, I've been in prison before. I get that. Right. But then in this case, he injected it into the conversation as part of his explanation of the reason for why he wanted to sell this. So that, I'm just wondering if the general rule you're talking about is really not accepted here.
I believe it is, Your Honor, because still what we have is that these principles are embedded in the constitutional principles that some, that a defendant is entitled to due process, a fair trial, and an impartial jury. And injecting unrelated prior criminality deprives the defendant of those rights.
But in this case, unlike the statement to the police officer where it's a separate question that has nothing to do with the crime before the police officer, it's not unrelated. He uses this as his explanation.
And Your Honor, again, I think that we have to look at the statement in the context of his constitutional rights to a fair trial. And again, that piece of evidence or that statement itself was not relevant or was not necessary for the for the jury's understanding of the facts. And to go back to the res gestae issue of whether this can constitute res gestae. Res gestae is evidence and information that is important and necessary to the jury's complete understanding of the facts. Here you have the statement by Mr. Holland to Mr. Art saying that he had recently, my name is Mr. Holland or Monty, is what he said. He had recently been released from prison, was trying to start up his own business. Things were tough, so he was selling his tools. That constituted the conversation that was had. If you excise that he had recently been released from prison, you still have remaining the statement that times were tough, he needed money, he was trying to start up his own business, and that's why he was selling his tools.
So isn't that argument, and I have to say, if those of you who read my opinions know I have some issues with res gestae and how much it gets used, but in this one, aren't you really suggesting an abuse of discretion kind of analysis, that you're saying the court, you really didn't need to hear about the prison because he talked about all that he needed money. It didn't matter why he needed the money. And so the court should have excised that. I mean, that's basically what you're saying, right?
That's correct.
Right. So I guess I'll come back for perhaps both of my colleagues asked this. I'm not familiar with a case that that would say it was an abuse of the discretion for the court not to do that. And as I'm sure you know, as I understand it, under 403 analysis, we have to assume the maximum probative value and the minimum prejudice to be expected. So in this case, I mean, that's a pretty high burden, assuming we get to that 403 analysis. Could you address that?
Sure. I think that the cases have established that sort of evidence is highly prejudicial. And when you look at that and you look at the cases, the Supreme Court precedent establishing that it's highly prejudicial, when you look at Costell, Stoll, and you look at Goldsberry, you see that cases have established that it's extremely prejudicial.
Let's look in the last 20 years, counsel, because I don't think we've taken the same categorical approach as, say, in Goldsberry. I think there's been a lot of cases decided since Goldsberry that have said, gee, references to this type of evidence is not necessarily prejudicial if it were error to begin with.
And I'm not aware of any case that says that we can start introducing defendants' prior criminality that's unrelated to the offense for which he's being charged.
Well, and I guess the hinge is, again, the unrelated.
That's correct. And if you look at the evidence itself, it's that he was in prison on a separate, wholly independent charge. We don't even know what that offense was. What we know is that he was convicted of a felon, and that it was serious enough to warrant him being in prison. And that's what the jury got to hear. And I think that there are no cases establishing that we get to get into a defendant's prior criminal conduct and their prior felony convictions. Because it doesn't come up. It's well established, it's settled law.
Well,
it just doesn't come in.
Well, again, this reference to the prior criminality in this instance, doesn't it explain a certain type of need? Not just the generic, I'm trying to start out a business and times are tough, but I'm really behind the eight ball because of a certain circumstance.
Well, I think that the flaw in that reasoning is that it requires one to conclude or make that inferential leap that being in prison necessarily means that you are financially needy or that only poor people commit crimes, both of which are unacceptable positions to take. I think in terms of Martha Stewart, for example, probably would not have been released from prison needing money, to give an example. That.
But does it matter, counsel? I'm sorry to interrupt you. Does it really matter? I mean, here, I hear you. You can't assume that everyone gets out of prison needs money. But in this case, the man said it. I mean, it's not, there's no assumption, and whether it's true or not, it doesn't matter. He said it.
He did say it. That's correct. But it was not necessary that the jury hear that. In order to uphold his constitutional rights to due process, a fair trial, and an impartial jury, it was necessary that that be excised. And his remaining statement still established that he was in need of money, and that's why he was selling. I think that the act itself of selling an item on Craigslist as well conveys to the jury that somebody needs money, or at the very minimum, wants money for the item that they're selling. And so I think that the trial court was wrong. And I would also point out that this was never even advanced by the prosecutor. The prosecutor didn't even argue that he should get into this prior criminality. This was solely taken up by the court, and the court made this conclusion without any argument by the prosecutor that this was necessary.
Pardon me, counsel. I'd like to ask you a hypothetical, because I want to see how far your argument about no prior criminality goes. Assume the following facts, and I know these facts are not this case. It's a hypothetical. There is a murder. A man is arrested for the murder. He says, I met the victim in prison. We had a gang beef in prison. That's where it started. I finished it out here. Is that admissible?
And the defendant being the person who was in prison?
Yes.
Yes. I do not think that that's admissible. And, you know, again, trial courts are faced with, your hypothetical is a little bit different because you're presuming that the witness or the victim is the one who's stating that he had a beef outside of prison.
No. It's the defendant. He admits to the murder, and he says, I met this fellow in prison. We were from different gangs. We developed a beef. After we were both released, I found him. I killed him.
I think that if the courts are interested in preserving defendants' constitutional rights to due process, a fair trial, and an impartial jury, they would tailor a ruling to eliminate or curb any prejudicial impact, or tailor the testimony so that it minimizes the prejudicial impact of stating that the defendant has been previously convicted of a felony. And I think that that does happen quite often. And I think that it was error in this case for the court to, on its own, argue that this evidence was otherwise admissible. And in this case, I think it was particularly prejudicial because this case turned on whether Mr. Holland knew that that item was stolen. There was evidence admitted that he figured that it was probably hot. There was evidence admitted that he had received the item from a friend named Ed. All of that evidence tended to at least create doubt as to whether he actually indeed knew that it was stolen or not. And when you have...
Wasn't there also evidence that he initially denied having it? And also, wasn't there evidence that he claimed it came first from his father and then from Ed?
That is correct. There was evidence of inconsistent statements as well. But there was enough evidence to create a doubt as to whether he knew that it was stolen, and that was the crux of this case. And evidence that he had been previously convicted of a felony and had recently been released from prison very well may have been what tipped the scales in this case. If I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Of course. Thank you, Ms. Weiss. Ms. Van Horn.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter.
Ms. Van Horn, before we begin, what do we make of the prosecution's response in the trial court? I don't know, it was said to some witness. That's what a prosecutor is supposed to do in determining the admissibility of this type of evidence?
I think the prosecutor was kind of surprised by the defense request to keep this out, wasn't even anticipating perhaps that it was going to come in. I think the prosecutor could have made a better argument below, or an argument at all, because as I recall, he didn't make much of an argument.
But wasn't there, and forgive me if I'm just not remembering the record, I thought the defendant made a motion in limine before, or that said keep out any reference to the criminality. Am I mistaken about that?
I think
that?
It was a generic motion that didn't specifically refer to the statement that was made by this particular witness.
Right. As just a total aside, Ms. Van Horn, I just speak for myself here. I don't know the process and whether you guys ever have the chance to communicate to the line DAs, but I would hope somewhere along the line someone would communicate to the line DAs that's saying, I don't know, is not sufficient argument and not helpful. I have some sympathy for you to have to come up here and try to defend it. And I think the DA got a little bit fortunate that the trial judge here came to, I can't remember if it was a man or woman, his or her rescue. Not all trial judges would do that, and I would hope that regardless of how this case comes out, you would convey down the line that we, the courts can have a right to expect all lawyers to be prepared, and that's, that kind of argument's not helpful. And yes, so sir. With respect, I say that. And you know,
thank
I've
you.
Been a trial lawyer, and I get it. Sometimes you do get surprised, and maybe that happened, but that wasn't really helpful and made our job difficult.
I agree.
Yours too.
Yeah.
And if I could add something to what Judge Gabriel said, we're not talking about extraordinarily complex legal analysis here. When you introduce a piece of evidence, you ought to have some notion of why it's admissible. And as Judge Gabriel pointed out, the statement that, I don't know, it was said by some witness, suggests very little thought about the case. And I just think we expect more of our trial counsel on both sides of the issue to be a little more thoughtful about why they're offering evidence.
I agree, Your Honor. And I, as I said, I don't even know if the prosecutor should have been, was even aware exactly what this witness's testimony would be, which is not good either. So I agree.
Okay. So while we've jumped in on you, Ms. Van Horn, thank you for your patience with that, because you, of course, were not the person who did it. We understand.
Yes.
Could you tell me why, and I suppose this is really asking you to respond to Ms. Weiss's argument, why did the jury need to know about the release from prison? Why, you know, couldn't the court have excised that piece and said, he said he needed money? I mean, I get, and you've heard our questions, that, you know, that's what he said. You know, but, you know, couldn't the court have excised that one little piece? And you got a whole statement about, I really need the money.
I do think it was relevant to his motive and his explanation as to why he needed the money. But I do understand the argument that he's talking about times are bad, it's desperate, I'm desperate, I need to start a business, may have been sufficient. Although I do think this gives a better explanation as to why he was claiming he needed the money. And I'd also like to point out that there was no evidence brought in that he was in fact in prison and jail, and they used both words interchangeably, or that he was in fact convicted of a felony or any offense. They were just saying, this is what he said. And that's all the evidence that came in. And it was just that one comment by that witness. And then when you look at the court's instructions, it's evidence that the defendant may have been in jail. So they're just bringing in what he said and
right.
What he said his reason was.
Right. But in other case law in this jurisdiction, they don't require something from which you can infer prior criminality to then be followed up with, and he actually did do time, and he actually was convicted of a felony, and the felony was this nature. Aren't there a lot of cases where a reference to having been in jail or prison in and of itself raises the inference of prior criminality?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. But
then there's no necessity then for any other evidence to raise this inference of criminality, is there?
But, Your Honor, in this case, it's what he said. It's not another witness saying, I met him in county jail, which I think is a little more of a reference to, yes, in fact, he was in county jail. It was just, he said he was, and I think when they were talking about this before the witness testified, they used jail. The witness used the word prison. Then the trial court used the word jail in the limiting instruction. And I do think that if there was any error at all in admitting this, it was just that one piece of testimony. It wasn't relied upon at all in closing. It wasn't repeated again. It would be harmless, particularly given it's this one brief little statement. The jury received a limiting instruction, and none of the information about this prior conviction, if in fact it existed, was admitted at all.
To go back to Judge Daly's question, the mere fact that it was said by the defendant isn't enough, right? I mean, we got rid of the rule of completeness some time ago.
Correct.
So there has to be a good reason to introduce this, just beyond the reason that he said it, right?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. And I think what the trial court here ruled correctly was it showed that he was desperate for finances. He was desperate for money to start a business. That's what he was saying. And then that's why he needed to sell this expensive piece of equipment. If the court has no further questions or any questions about the other issues.
Yeah, I would just ask you about the mistake of fact instruction piece of this. You talk about the statute, and I guess you drew a distinction between, well, it's not superfluous, but it's redundant. And I'm not sure I understood the distinction you were making. What's the difference between redundant and superfluous?
Well the rule is mistake of fact is not a defense. So if we don't have the exceptions, it can be a defense, right? Mistake is not a defense. Unless we have these exceptions, then there would be a conflict between any statute that requires a mental state. So that's why it's there.
I understood that part, but then you go on to say, and Ms. Vizet argued in her brief, that it was makes it superfluous in any case where you have a knowingly requirement. And you said, no, it's not superfluous, but it's redundant. And I guess I didn't understand the distinction.
Well, it's redundant as to those cases generally. And I was actually trying to think of a case where you could actually use mistake of fact. The only thing I could think of were very bizarre. Somebody thinks they're part of some big elaborate hoax or joke, you know, but I couldn't think of just a general case where you would need it, where you had a crime where the mental state was going.
Your point is that the statute exists here because it starts with mistake of fact, regardless of the case or the mens rea. Mistake of fact is not a defense unless
one of those exceptions applies, how right. It relates to the other two affirmative defenses, self-defense, et cetera, et cetera.
I just wanted to make sure I understood. Thank you.
Was there any evidence in the record to support either a mistake of fact instruction, either as an affirmative defense or a theory of the case instruction?
No, Your Honor. The only evidence in the record, he told the detective initially that he got the pipe threader from his father. And when the detective asked him, well, give me your father's information, he said, well, actually, I got it from Ed. And then he said, it's probably hot. So that it's not a situation where he said or where there was any other evidence that he bought it from somebody or that he got it under circumstances under which he truly believed that it was not stolen. And I was thinking, you know, when it comes to myself, you know, there are people who could give me something really expensive and maybe I would have no reason to believe that it was stolen and that would sort of come out in my statement, whereas there are other people who could give me the same thing and I would certainly realize that they didn't come by it through legitimate means. So, there was nothing in this record to show that he did not think it was stolen. The court has no further questions. I'd ask that the defendant's conviction be affirmed.
Thank you, Ms. Van Horn.
Thank you.
Ms. Weiss, you've got a minute and 24 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to hit on two things. First of all, Judge Daly, you asked about within the last 30 years that there's case law that established that prior criminality would not come in. And I do think that this court...
No, that's not quite what I asked. I think I asked, hasn't Goldsberry in that line of cases mm-hmm. been softened or altered a bit? I don't think I said there's no case law in 30 years.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought you were inviting me to try and give you some case law, and I would just...
Actually, I am inviting you. you actually did read it. And also, I would invite Judge Gabriel to give you another half minute since I have wasted your half minute.
Thank you, Aaron. I would just point to Usum and Kaufman and the 404B cases as being cases that generally resolve this issue as well. Under a 404 404B analysis, but employing that 403 analysis as well. And that goes to any prior transactions, other acts, incidents, not just prior felony convictions or evidence that indicates prior felony conviction. Additionally, as to the mistake of fact, I would just point out that under Nunez, the court was required to give a mistake of fact or alter the theory of defense to include that defense.
Well, what was the evidence to support mistake of fact?
Thank you. I'm trying to ramble off here. I apologize.
We'll let you make this point.
The evidence to support mistake of fact included that he stated to the detective he figured it was probably hot. And as Ms. Van Horn mentioned, there are some people who give you items that you would know it was not stolen. There are some people who would give you items that you would presume it was stolen. And there are some people who give you items where you would think that maybe this is a little bit sketchy and this may not be, I have questions. But mere suspicion is not enough, and that was what the defendant was trying to get embodied in his theory of defense instruction. Additionally, he said that he had received it from his friend Ed, and that's enough under a mere scintilla standard to get that evidence in.
I don't think you can quite separate he received it from his friend Ed from he received it from his father from it's probably hot from the I'm not going to open up or show you the pipe threader. I'm not sure you can just parcel out each piece of that little evidence that seemed to have occurred fairly quickly or in very quick order in connection with each other.
And what I would do is I would look at Castles v. People, which is cited in my brief, and that case holds for the proposition that any evidence, regardless of how improbable, slight, or minor that evidence is, would support a defendant's theory of defense instruction. And with that, I'd ask the court to reverse Mr. Holland's conviction and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, Ms. Weiss. And we thank you again, Ms. Van Horn. We thank you both for your briefs and your oral arguments. In this case, the case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. With that concludes our docket this morning. So the court will be in recess and the bailiff may so announce.